Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm very happy to let you all know that Winona Howder will be joining me again today on my show. Winona is the founder and executive director of Food and Water Watch, and she'll be coming on in just a little bit. But of course, before we get there, I want to talk to you about some things going on in and around the city, as well as some petitions I want to ask you to participate in and some issues we just need to talk about. But coming up, we had a wonderful summer solstice with Slow Food North Shore this past weekend. It was just wonderful. We had about 50 people here and live music, and it was just a wonderful coming together of community. And one of the things that was really special this time is there was a really cross-generation gathering. There were, you know, from babies to 20, 30-somethings to, you know, 40, 50, 60, and 70. I mean, it was just great. There's really a cross-section of people who care about good, clean, and fair food, and so it was just wonderful. Coming up, July 6th, there's a Women in Agriculture conference going on, and this looks really great. It is going to be taking place out on Long Island. Amanda and Katie from Amber Waves Farm in Amagansett will be hosting this event. It's from 6:30 to 8:30 on July 6th. And they share, you know, their journey. They share how they founded their CSA. They're sharing their Amagansett Wheat Project. And it just will be a wonderful educational opportunity, as well as, you know, an opportunity to taste some of their delicious bread that they're making. We had them in our as participants in our food and film feast this year at the Cinema Arts Center, and they're just wonderful. So if you can make it to that, you should. July 8th through the 17th is the Long Island Food Truck Rodeo. That takes place out in the Southampton Elks Lodge, but it's going on for, you know, from the 8th to the 17th. So you have plenty of time to check it out. Lots of food trucks will be there, as well as craft vendors, farmers markets, music, local beer. So it should be a fun time. General $5 for general admission, so it's something that's affordable for everybody. Also, I want to tell you about a screening that is taking place out at the Cinema Arts Center, a screening of the film Vaxxed. If you haven't seen this movie, it is really great. It's a movie about the MMR vaccination, and it is not a movie that is completely against vaccinations, which I think, you know, it got a bad rap where people think it's just completely against vaccinations. It's not, but it's against really looking at how vaccinations are given to our kids, how many are given at a time, what combinations. Anyway, it's a really great movie. It's testament to all these parents who have, you know, gone through this with their children, and it's also a movement to allow us to be able to make choices for our children, which sometimes our government is trying to take away from us. So come out to the Cinema Arts Center on July 16th and check that out. That's July 13th. July 16th, North Shore Land Alliance is having a walk in the woods. This one is going to be at a home in West Hampton. You can go onto the North Shore Land Alliance website to find out about it. It's in the middle of the afternoon from 1 to 3. It's right on the water. It should be really beautiful. So check that out. There's also on July 17th, there's a summer sunset on the bay potluck, and this is a Slow Food East End potluck out in West Hampton. Also should be a wonderful, wonderful event. And then, please join Slow Food North Shore and the Long Island Food Coalition for a bus trip out to the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania. Rodale Institute is an over 300-acre organic research farm, and we are going to be touring the farm and having an organic agricultural workshop. Lunch is included, so please sign up for that. There's still room on the bus, and we would love to fill that bus. So come out to that. July 23rd, there's a farm-to-table benefit dinner to benefit the Sylvia Center, which is a wonderful educational center on the Lower East Side in the city that really reaches underprivileged children teaching them about food and healthy eating. Anyway, this is a farm-to-table benefit dinner at their farm up in at Catskee Farm, which is upstate New York, but not far from the city. So check that out. And all of these are on my website, so you can really check that out. Also, there's some petitions that I have listed that I'd like your support in. One is about the DARC Act, the Monsanto Dream Bill, which is a bill that they're trying to push through Congress that will make individual states' rights of mandatory labeling for GMOs illegal. So we really need to stop this bill in its tracks. We did it already, and it's back. So it seems like, the pressure that we have from the lobbyists in Washington is just relentless, and we have to keep up the fight. So please sign this bill to make GMO labeling an option. I'd love to have it mandatory in every state, but to have a bill that makes it illegal for states to make their own laws is ridiculous. So please sign that. There is also a petition to remove carrageenan from our foods. The National Organic Standards Board, which is the governing policy or the governing part of the USDA that decides what foods can be in organic foods, is really siding with big business and not siding with people who care about their food. And carrageenan has been shown to cause intestinal problems, bowel syndrome problems. It's even linked to cancer. But the USDA is choosing to ignore those scientific research facts and is still allowing it. So this is a petition to try to get carrageenan out of organics. And the National Organic Standards Board is also really struggling people who care about it think it's struggling because they have a certain amount of spaces allotted for different people who are involved in deciding what should be organic. So there's a certain amount of spaces for farmers, a certain amount of spaces for business, a certain amount of spaces for industry. And right now, the spaces that are allotted for farmers are also being infiltrated by people who have big connections to Monsanto and the like. So we really need to strengthen the National Organic Standards Board and make that it really be representative of the cross-section that it is supposed to represent. So beware of that. The Environmental Working Group is a wonderful nonprofit organization, as well as Cornucopia, and they both have lists on their websites that list things that are safe for us and rate different products. And this time of year, I always want to draw everyone's attention to the Environmental Working Group's list for safe sunscreens. Everyone's concerned about, skin cancer, and so they glob sunscreen on, and they glob it on their children as well, without realizing that our skin is our largest organ. And when you put all these chemicals all over your child's skin, they are absorbing that into their bodies. And so you don't want to put something on that's toxic. So check out this list on the Environmental Working Group. I have a link from my website, or just go to ewg.org and check out the list they have. They're really a great organization. And now, before I invite Winona on, I'd like to share my weekly recipe with you. Right now I am harvesting lots of bok choy and escarole, snow peas, sugar snap peas, all from my garden. So I know you've been seeing a lot of those ingredients in my recipes, but that's the way it is. So this one is a sesame bok choy and snow peas with rice noodles. I start with 1 pound package of rice noodles cooked al dente, according to the package directions or just by taste. 4 large organic baby bella mushrooms, 1 onion cut into slivers, 4 cups cut, washed, and spun bok choy, 2 tablespoons chopped ginger, 2 tablespoons chopped garlic, 4 cups snow peas cut on an angle, olive oil, 1 teaspoon of cornstarch, and I use that just to thicken the sauce just a little bit so it really stays on the vegetables. You can use a little more or you can leave it out. 2 tablespoons aji marin, quarter cup of tamari, 2 tablespoons dark sesame oil, and 1 teaspoon hot sesame oil. And then I also made a little sauce with 1/4 cup of tahini, 1 tablespoon chopped garlic, 1/4 sized piece of ginger, 1 tablespoon mirin, and 1 teaspoon of hot sesame oil. And the hot sesame oil is always optional. And then I also put in 1/4 cup of chopped peanuts, which if you have a peanut allergy, you can also leave that out. So as I said, you're going to cook the pasta according to the directions and try to time it so that the pasta is ready right when the vegetables are ready. So get the water boiling, but don't put the rice noodles in until you're almost finished with the vegetables. Sauté the onions in olive oil until they're translucent. Add the bok choy, the ginger, and the garlic, and cook for about 3 minutes at a high heat, stirring constantly. Add the baby portobello mushrooms and cook for another 3 minutes. Make a mixture of the cornstarch, the mirin, and the tamari. Add that to the vegetables. Then add the snow peas and cook for 1 minute. Add the hot sesame oil if you're using that. And you can make the sauce in the mini food processor or blender. Just put all those ingredients in together, blend that up. Then drain the noodles when they're ready. Pour the noodles on top of the vegetables that are in your wok and toss them up. Pour on the sauce and just toss gently. You don't want to break up the noodles too much, and serve it immediately. Of course, add the peanuts as garnish on top. And that's it. It comes together so quickly and easily. You know, and I'm doing lots of these meals during the day, during the week, because I have some college students working with me in the garden, and I have a lot of mouths to feed, and this just, you know, comes together so quickly, and it really fills them up. So it's great. So enjoy. I love feedback. Let me know if you make it, how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Winona Howder, the founder of Food and Water Watch. She's also an activist, author, and a policy advocate. Food and Water Watch is an organization that under her leadership has transformed the national debate about hydraulic fracking, energy, and the environment. Her new book is called Frackopoly, and I'm going to invite her on to talk to us about fracking and her book. Winona, are you with me?
I am so glad to be here this morning.
Thank you, and I'm thrilled to have you. So let's start from, first, can you just tell my listeners, in case there's anyone out there that still doesn't know what fracking is, can you just give a brief overview of what fracking is?
Well, sure. Over the past decade, oil and gas production has just increased dramatically because of the unprecedented use of these new techniques and technologies. So fracking employs this really science fiction-like process where the drillers inject millions of gallons of water and dangerous chemicals and very fine sand under extreme pressure to extract oil and natural gas from rock formations that are very deep underground. They drill a deep vertical well up to 2 miles deep. And then the fracking takes place in multiple stages along a horizontal tunnel that's several inches wide. And it runs for a mile or two through the targeted rock formation. And this is all taking place, of course, thousands of feet underground.
Mm-hmm. And it's on land that, you know, that people live near, correct? It's not always
often
on
it's
desert.
Very close to where people live. And we know that fracking harms human health. The research on health effects, of course, is in the early stages because of the time delays between exposure and the development of an illness. But already, 84% of the existing public health studies show harms to human health. And in 2015, separate studies looked at health outcomes in Pennsylvania, which, of course, is where a tremendous amount of fracking has taken place. And there is a very significant association between living near a fracking operation and premature birth, and increased hospitalization rates for cardiac and neurological diseases in the places where people are being exposed to the dirty air and the dirty chemicals. And further, Dimmock, Pennsylvania, where the EPA actually began an investigation of water pollution several years ago and then abruptly closed the investigation right before President Obama's re-election in 2012. But recently, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, they confirmed that the private well water had been contaminated with a lot of the different compounds that threaten health and safety. And then following this, researchers in Wyoming, which is another state where EPA had began an investigation and then abruptly closed it in 2012, they documented carcinogenic, neurotoxic, and endocrine-disrupting chemicals both in air emissions and in the urine of residents living near oil and gas operations. So we know from working with many, many people around the country, these impacted people who live very close to these operations, that there are a range of illnesses associated with living near a fracking operation. And today there are 17 million people who live within 1 mile of a fracking operation.
Wow, 17 million.
Yeah, I mean, figure there are 140,000 fracked wells across the country. So
how many? 147,000?
140,000.
140,000, wow. I had no idea so many.
As prices begin to go up again, and we know that one of the things about the oil and gas industry, and I confirmed this in my research, there is a boom-bust cycle. And this has been true since the very beginning of the oil industry prior to the turn of the 20th century. Prices go up, and then the operators, the big companies, get greedy, and production goes up, and then there's overproduction, and then prices go down. That is the history of the oil and gas industry.
Mm-hmm. So what inspired you to write a whole book on fracking?
Well, we, of course, at Food and Water Watch have been campaigning across the country in many of our 16 offices and states, from, of course, New York, where we were part of a coalition that successfully banned fracking, to places like Colorado, where communities banned fracking, and where we're now in a big fight to pass a ballot initiative to allow communities really be in charge of their own future related to fracking, and other states like California, where Governor Brown is supposed to be a climate hero but has done everything possible to allow fracking in his state. So because of these campaigns, I really started looking at how have we gotten to a place that even most of our Democratic governors, many of the people in the leadership of the Democratic Party, are in favor of natural gas and in favor of fracking. And I also started looking at the statistics around renewable energy, because in the 1990s, I worked on a project called Powering the Midwest, and the truth is that even then, renewable technologies were ready, and we could have quickly transitioned into a renewable energy and energy efficiency future if there had been the political will. So fast forward all of these years, and I looked at the statistics, and in fact, in 2015, only 5.5% of our electricity is generated from solar, wind, and geothermal. And I thought, that is a real outrage. We hear how the price of renewables has come down and how the big increases in renewables. But, you know, 5,000%, a 0.1% isn't a whole lot. So I decided to really investigate and to make the case that the market alone is not going to move us into this critical transition. We're going to have to build the political will, and that means engaging many, many, many people across the country and building our political power.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm hopeful that your book can help to do that. You know, and there's so many issues. I mean, we're just bombarded with so many issues where the need for mobilization of the masses of people are so important to combat the lobbyists and the power that be. Our political people are so intertwined with big business and the lobbyists that it's just, you know, they forget who voted them in. Although,
well,
I guess so.
That's right.
You know, with Citizens United, I guess the corporations are voting them in too with all their money. But it's just terrible. It's terrible.
Well, you know, we really don't have any choice now because we are facing a future that if we do not quickly do something to reduce our emissions, really we need to act significantly in the next year, next 10 years, because we are reaching a critical tipping point with climate change, or I think it's more aptly called climate chaos. And the scientific evidence just is continuing to mount about the potential of fracking to intensify and hasten climate chaos. And, you know, we all have heard the rhetoric about burning natural gas to produce electricity, and that it releases about half as much carbon dioxide as burning coal. And that is true once the gas actually gets to the gas-fired turbines, it doesn't produce as much carbon dioxide. But this is really offset by the leakage of methane during the process of drilling and fracking and processing and transporting the gas to the power plant, because methane, which of course is the main component of natural gas, leaks into the atmosphere up to twice the rate that was estimated by the U.S. EPA. And this is very important. Twice as much methane is going into the atmosphere than the EPA has admitted. And the other thing about methane is it degrades much faster in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. It's a much more efficient heat-trapping gas. And in fact, the very influential Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimates that a pound of methane traps almost 100 times as much heat as carbon dioxide in the first 20 years after it's emitted. And that's a very important point. Almost 100 times a more potent greenhouse gas in the first 20 years. And this is the period that we should be taking very fast action to transition into a renewable energy future. And this is being ignored by many of the people in a policy-making position in our nation. They're using a 100-year time frame, which isn't really what we should be looking at. We should be looking at how to take the fastest action in the next decade or two. And the recent climate science really shows that, and this is shocking, it shows that switching to natural gas is unlikely to reduce greenhouse emissions for many, many decades. And that's the crucial time frame when we really have to stop this runaway climate disruption. And when you look at the whole life cycle of producing gas, the damage from methane leakage really puts it on par with coal. And mm-hmm. I think that is, that's the information that I'm really trying to get out with Fracopoly, because even the most conservative estimate from measuring the atmosphere shows that natural gas leakage in 2010, when we have the data, it averaged over the country to more than 3% of U.S. production that year. And if the methane leakage could be brought down significantly over time, which is very debatable, the threat to climate change in the short term is so real. So this rapid transition to natural gas is really sending us to the tipping point where climate change can't be reversed. And, you know, and it really is about the entrenched position of the oil and gas industry in our politics and the economy. And I really was able, in going back through the history of how we got here today, able to document their privileged status under the law and how they have an iron grip on public policy. And, you know, I really believe you have to know where you've been to know where you're going. And so through writing this story, and I write it as a kind of like a detective story with a lot of heroines and heroes and also all of the villains that brought us here today. And I think that we see what policies have to be changed. But it really is about building the political power state by state to take back our democracy.
One of the scariest things that I'm hearing and seeing is that with the awareness of trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and fracking not being the answer, people are now starting to look at nuclear power again, as if that's the answer, as opposed to renewables. And that is totally scary. I mean, to think that, you know, Indian Point, they closed last week because it was leaking here in New York, and, you know, it's now reopened, but it's, you know, nuclear power is certainly not the answer. And you know, people rallying to switch from natural gas and oil, you know, rather than going towards wind and solar and geothermal, they're going towards, you know, reopening nuclear power plants. What can we do about that?
Well, you know, one of the things that we've seen over time, and I've worked on issues related to nuclear power for years. In fact, I was an anti-nuclear activist when I was young in the 1970s, and of course, it is ridiculous and very dangerous to boil water using a nuclear reactor and then to run a turbine to generate electricity. But the nuclear industry has always been extremely powerful and well-placed in political circles, and they've seen an opportunity to jump in here and to try to also cause division in the communities that are fighting fracking and dirty energy by asserting that if nukes are closed, it will mean more natural gas production. And, of course, mm-hmm. that is not true. It does not mean that we have to have more natural gas production. What we have to do is put into firm place the public policies that will transition us into renewables, and that means having very strong renewable portfolio standards, which require utilities and states to generate a certain amount of their electricity from renewables. And of course, we need to transition immediately into both saving energy and into generating our electricity from renewables, especially in light of the fact that one of the scenarios for getting off of dirty fossil fuel run automobiles is to have electric automobiles and many other industrial processes. So we really have to clean up our electricity system. So state by state, the oil industry has been trying to impact renewable portfolio standards. It's the oil and gas industry and other ideological opponents of renewables. And they have been attacking the renewable portfolio standards on the books and also trying to get rid of the net metering requirements. And, of course, we need to both strengthen the portfolio standards and we need to require that the utilities buy back energy from rooftop solar and the other alternative energy sources that people are deploying. And so there has been attack on this net metering, which basically means that you generate electricity on your roof, then you can turn the electricity back to the local utility, and they can use it on the grid. So, you know, one of the difficult things about working on energy issues is the devil is in the detail. And you have a lot of corporate interests, consulting firms, and the financial services industry that tries to disguise it in a lot of rhetoric. And sometimes it's difficult for people to really understand what's going on. And I do think that the point about the financial services industry is important because we know that Wall Street is one of the big drivers of dirty energy. In fact, right now they have $200 billion and probably more since we've looked at the statistics that they've invested in building another 40 years of natural gas infrastructure. And we know these battles over pipelines, liquefied natural gas plants, and other infrastructure are going on all across the country. So the financial services industry really profits from dirty energy. And they also are becoming owners of dirty energy, not just the speculation and the betting on derivatives and all of the things that happen on commodity markets that make it like a casino. But, for instance, Goldman Sachs is now one of the largest owners of actual natural gas production, and they are making long-term contracts with the different users of natural gas, sometimes communities, sometimes industrial customers. So there's a lot to be done, but it all begins with people understanding how the system works.
Mm-hmm. And you go into that a lot in your book. And, you know, one of the things that you also talk about is you talk about the boom and bust nature of the oil and gas industry. Can you talk a little bit about that, why that's so important?
Right. Well, you know, we hear a lot of talk now that, well, the industry's going bust, so there must be something in the economics that means that oil and gas use will be in decline. But unfortunately, the boom and bust cycle, as I said earlier, is really part of this commodity-driven system. When prices are high, companies do as much production as possible, and that means there's more oil and gas than is being consumed. So the industry also looks for new ways to use oil and gas, and that's why the 40-year ban on exporting oil was very sneakily removed in December. It's what the push for exporting liquefied natural gas is all about today. And there's so much hypocrisy about it all because, of course, the frackers, the oil and gas industry, did a whole public propaganda campaign around natural gas being for energy independence. But once there was overproduction, then it became about helping our allies be independent. And it's also important to note at this point that 80% of the fracking since 2012 has been for oil, not natural gas. And that is not discussed very much. And the other point is that when oil comes out of the ground, every single component of it is put into production. So today, between 70 and 80% of natural gas is used to produce plastic. So, you know, we have a big job ahead of us. We really need to turn our economy away from an oil-based economy into one that is focused on benefiting everybody, not just a few of the big economic interests that make big profits from speculating on Wall Street. We need to actually have an economy that is based on producing useful things that are being made in a sustainable way. And that means having energy production be more localized and having it distributed. And one of the big problems that we're running into that most people haven't followed, because, of course, our media is not telling the whole story, a point I want to get to in a couple of minutes, but one of the problems is that in 2005, a lot of policy changes were made in the 2005 Energy Policy Act. And most people who know about fracking remember that that was the legislation that exempted the oil and gas industry from the Safe Drinking Water Act, known as the Halliburton loophole. But this legislation did two other really sneaky things. It repealed a very important law from the 1930s that prohibited electric utilities from becoming so big that they weren't really serving their core base of customers, and it enabled them to become giant monopolies. And so today we have 20 giant electric companies that are controlling a lot of both the debate about fracking and even nuclear power, but also production, and they are all about an all-of-the-above strategy. And so that their monopolized power is having a big influence on both state and federal law. Now, the other thing that happened in that Energy Policy Act of 2005 is that the agency that makes decisions about whether electric or natural gas infrastructure can be built, and that's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is a rogue agency. The president names the commissioners, and it acts as an independent agency, a dictator over these issues. Its power was increased, and this agency, known by its acronym called FERC, now has authority over one of our nation's most important environmental laws, the National Environmental Policy Act, which says that if there's a big construction project or something like a large pipeline being built or an LNG facility, that there has to be an environmental assessment. FERC is now in charge of that environmental assessment. And they also were given the right of eminent domain, which means that they can condemn land, and
right.
And they are able to basically dictate if these projects can be built. So it's very complex, but there are a number of places that we need to insert ourselves and change policies.
Right. And fracking also goes in and wreaks havoc on the towns that they affect, not only
through the economy. I mean, was reading about, the towns where they go in and, all of a sudden there's this boom and there's not enough housing, and so they build housing and they build more stores and they are hiring and more restaurants and everyone, there's this boom going, and then when there's overproduction and they cut back, all of a sudden there's no jobs for people. People, have to either go on welfare or move out of the state and look for other work. And then also, of course, we'll talk more about the sickness and stuff that comes with it, but there's also been increased earthquakes from fracking. Isn't that true?
Well, yes. The earthquakes really come from dealing with the wastewater. And, of course, enormous amounts of wastewater surge up out of these fracked wells, and something has to be done with it. And in many parts of the country, it is injected deep underground. It's called deep well injection. And it's now been verified, even by the U.S. Geologic Service, that it is increasing earthquakes. And Oklahoma is a very good example of this. Oklahoma used to have 1 to 3 3-point magnitude earthquakes a year. They are now having 5,000 or more earthquakes a year, and this is happening in Arkansas, in Ohio, many parts of the country where we're seeing these earthquakes. So it's very, there are so many unintended consequences.
Uh-huh.
And I think, the wastewater, or actually the use of water, is one of the most important issues that we should mention about fracking.
Sure.
Fracking uses 50 times more water than conventional natural gas drilling. So it really threatens scarce water resources because fracking is taking place in so many water-stressed parts of the country,
like
whether
California.
It's California, Texas, Colorado. And the water use varies by region, but nationally, about half the wells use more than 1.7 million gallons of water for each well. In Pennsylvania, the drillers are using between 4 million and 5.5 million gallons. And in Texas, in some places, they're using as much as 13 million gallons. And you'll hear the industry claim that water use is relative to overall consumption. But, statistics that are based on averages over large regions are really deceptive. And the use of water for fracking is very intensive, and it happens in a local hotspot for the drilling and fracking, and all at once for this new well. So you're really seeing a tremendous amount of water used in a locality where it is impacting the water resources. And it also puts our vital aquifers at risk, really, for generations because of the toxic fracking fluid and the unleashing of the toxic chemicals deep underground. What happens is that these fractures from the process creates new and really undetected pathways for contaminants to flow over time. We don't even know exactly what happens underground. And because they're using so many different toxic chemicals in these fluids, many of which are documented human health hazards or even carcinogens. I mean, I'm talking about things like benzene and toluene and different endocrine disruptors and acids that actually eat away the pathways so that the fossil fuels can flow. And then, as I mentioned, a lot of that wastewater returns to the surface in the first days and weeks after it's been injected. And that means that a lot of that fracking fluid has to be dealt with. And it also contains many other substances that are deep underground and should not be brought to the surface. I mean, I'm talking about things like radioactive material, corrosive salts, toxic metals, things that are deep underground in these rock formations. And then you have all of the leaks and the blowouts and the spills that involve these really hazardous wastes. And they aren't typically sent to treatment facilities.
Right, they're not being regulated.
And that's one of the big problems.
Yeah, I've heard they're even making, you know, de-icing the roads with this fracking water.
That is right. And in fact, that's one of the battles that we're having in some states, is trying to prohibit the use of fracking fluids on roads. I mean, can you imagine anything more ludicrous? And then all of that fracking fluid washes off into local streams. I mean, it is a completely unsustainable process.
Wow. So it's just so scary. Can you talk about one of the historical figures in the book that you outline and their lasting impact?
Sure. Oh, wow. There are so many villains. I mean, how else can I describe them as villains? I mean, I think one of the people who really stuck with me, and in fact, I actually ended up reading a 1,000-page biography about him, is John J. McCloy. And McCloy is a very interesting figure. He was a Harvard-trained lawyer who was very close to the Rockefeller family. And, of course, the oil and gas industry began as Standard Oil under J.D. Rockefeller. And McCloy had a career that spanned 5 decades. He served in interlocking roles as an advisor to 9 presidents, director of a number of major corporations. He was a legal counsel to the petroleum industry and a diplomat. And one of my favorite things that he said is, why the Constitution is just a scrap of paper. And what he did is facilitate the monopoly status of the oil and gas industry that really continues today. He advocated for the right of the oil industry to be exempt from regulations that govern competition. And he was a real power broker. He started in the Roosevelt administration and ran the War Department for his elderly boss, Henry Stinson. I mean, he made a lot of really terrible decisions. He was involved in advocating to resettle the Japanese in internment camps. He failed to recommend military action against Nazi death camps. He was appointed a high commissioner for Germany, where he commuted the sentences of convicted Nazi war criminals. And then after the war, he pursued the welfare of his corporate clients, especially the oil and gas industry. And he was a mentor to several generations of Rockefellers. He served in this dizzying number of capacities: president of the World Bank, chairman of the Ford Foundation, chairman of Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan Bank. He was on the Warren Commission. But anyway, he used his influence with presidents to advocate for the oil and gas industry. He argued for the golden gimmick, which is a tax break for oil companies that operate in Saudi Arabia that still remains in place today.
And when was he alive? When was this time?
He was alive from early 1900s. He died in the 1980s.
Uh-huh.
And so he advocated for these big oil companies, which at the time were ExxonMobil, BP, Texaco, Shell, Gulf, and Chevron. Of course, there have been major mergers since that time, and we're left only with Exxon, Chevron, and BP and Shell today. But what he would do is get them exempted from antitrust laws, which meant that they could conspire together to fix prices and to actually kind of subvert our democratic process. And then in the 1980s, of course, when Ronald Reagan was elected, these companies had become so large that they were involved in helping to get him elected, and that's when our antitrust laws were eviscerated and what the oil and gas industry had been trying to achieve all along, that is getting, you know, as large as they desired, which brings a lot of political power, right? A lot of political power that that they have such an impact today. But I wouldn't want to end our discussion without saying that I have a lot of hope today.
Well, and, and I would like to do that because we are getting close to the end, and I would also like you to tell people what they can do to help mobilize this movement to turn this around.
Well, first of all, I think we can see that our ban fracking movement is gaining in political power. That's why it's been a big debate in the nomination for the Democrats' presidential candidate. It's only when you have a lot of political power that you can raise an issue to the top. So I'm hopeful because of all of the young people who've engaged in politics for the first time or challenging the status quo, and I believe that we can keep this revolution for change going. And I would invite everybody to come to Philadelphia on July 23rd and 24th to be part of this clean energy revolution. We're having a summit in Philadelphia on the 23rd, and we are having a march for a clean energy revolution on the 24th, which is the day before the Democratic Convention begins. And after the convention, and really after the election, what we have to do is congressional district, state by state, start putting pressure on our elected officials. And, you know, we have to do it for both parties because Democrats have, in most cases, been as bad as Republicans. So I'm very hopeful because we see a lot of excitement. For instance, in Maryland, we'll be fighting for a ban on fracking this year. We want a moratorium. And there's a lot of progress being made in many parts of the country. So I would invite people to go to our website, foodandwaterwatch.org. And you can also go to my books website if you want to order a book or want more information about the book. And that is www.fracopoly, which is spelled FRACKOPOLY.org.
Yes, and I have links to all of that on my website this week. And I will also have a link to Food and Water Watch's website page where you can take a bus to come to Philadelphia for the Clean Energy Revolution March. So all very exciting. Winona, you're doing an amazing job. Thank you so much for all the work that you do on behalf of all of us that hopefully will reap the benefits of a world that is safe from fracking.
Right,
right. Well, Food and Watch is an amazing organization. And you can also, for those of you that are not members, you can join Food and Water Watch and become a sustaining member. And I know I am, and I think your organization, Winona, is just amazing. So thank you.
Thank you so much for the invitation to be here
Sure.
today.
And everybody
out there.
I always
enjoy being on your show.
Thanks. Everybody out there, thank you for listening in. And we'll be with you again next week. And have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.